Hi, I'm Hannah.
And I'm Kira.
This is a BBC Sherlock podcast, where we are doing a Watsonian analysis of the show, series 1 through 4.
Whether you're initiated, a veteran fan, or just wondering why series 4 was like that, we have you covered.
Listen to our discussion as we play The Great Game. The first episode, we talked about the Great Game, what it is, like historically, the tradition of it, how it relates to the BBC Sherlock, the show in general, specifically why it's relevant to understanding series 4. And the final problem, we didn't get into the actual episode of the final problem, but we talked about like the final problem as a concept that the show presents us. And then we talked about Nox, the thought of as the person that started the tradition of the Great Game. There was a couple things that we need to recap or talk about that we kind of forgot to mention in the last one. There's so many things to talk about that we can't possibly do everything in the most organized way, unless it were scripted. But the one thing I wanted to mention, which I kicked myself for, we talked for like almost 2 hours, but I was kicking myself because I neglected to mention one of the most important parts. And Amy talks about it in her meta, Poetry or Truth, in the section that she talks about the Great Game. And I made a note of it, but then I just completely neglected to talk about it. And that's that Nox talks about his theory, I think so, about why Watson would be fabricating events or editing events. The idea that after the fall, after he died, during those 2 years, whether he actually stayed dead or didn't, that I think it was during that time that Mary Watson or Mrs. Watson died at some point. During those 2 years. It was 2 years in the canon, right?
I believe so.
But then he was alone, and the words like he used specifically are that he was a bit of a gadabout and he was a spendthrift. And there was definitely a lot of nods to him being a little bit of a drinker. We open on him at a bar, in, like the beginning of Study in Scarlet. So yeah, he likes to drink. And so there's a little bit of subtext there that he got into that, and he had his drinking problem. He's alone and needed to make some money. And that's a reference that Amy makes to the lying detective, because in these fabricated or edited stories or the reusing of old stories, in the lying detective, we get Faith, which is a huge mirror for John and callback to Steady Pink. And before he met Sherlock Holmes during that time, and there's a connection to the lying detective, like in this point, if he's reusing stories or fabricating things or editing them, that he's alone, or he says it to Faith, quote unquote Faith, that she's alone, suicidal, and strapped for cash or something like that. Mm-hmm. Definitely strapped for cash. That's the big point. So yes. I don't know if that actually means that he's actually selling these stories, because I don't know what the implication is. I think it might just be a connection to, or a callback maybe to.
Yeah, I remember that being a connection I think Ronald Nox made. That the reason that the later stories, quote unquote, fell in quality, mm-hmm, was because Watson was strapped for cash. So he was making up the stories to make money.
Right. And it's funny because Watson or John, it's kind of how I tend to differentiate between canon and the shows. John doesn't sell the stories. He just writes it on the blog. It's all for free. So I don't know what that means for the show specifically during series four.
Yeah, I don't know if that necessarily has an implication.
Right, but I don't think it does necessarily.
I think more than anything, it's a callback to that specific observation that Ronald mm-hmm. Knox made.
Yeah.
And also a callback to John's state in the first episode.
Yeah. Yeah, because he does have a... I think it's really stronger in the first season, because that's... We're not... Yeah, because in Study in Pink, he can't afford a flat in central London, or really mm-hmm. in London, on his own. He needs a... That's why he needs a roommate, and it doesn't come up a whole lot, except in the blind banker, mm-hmm. because he uses the credit card to get groceries, and he can't afford it.
He has to borrow it from Sherlock.
And then he's like, Sherlock very much is he's dismissive. He doesn't really care about the money that he's being offered. Mm-hmm. He gets written the check by whatever his name is, and John he just walks away. He leaves it, and John like, oh, thank you. And he definitely says like, oh, no, we need the money, thank you very much, even if you don't, I do. I think it's just kind of more relevant to what is going on in John's life outside of the main focus of the stories. Because if he's not seeing... that's another part that he says, that in the stories, he's strapped for cash because he's not really seeing patients. I don't know if he's turned them away or he's just not actively looking for them. He's just not seeing people regularly. He's a doctor, but he's not practicing it regularly enough, so he's not really pulling in any money. And I think that's probably the implication in the show, more so than he's selling the stories, because mm-hmm. there's no precedent in the show that he's gonna sell the stories. But I think it's just telling that that's where he's at, because he's probably not going to work if his supposedly, you know, because or presumably because his wife died, and so he's really depressed and he stays home all the time, so he's not working. And I think that's really just the most indicative, but I think that's a important characterization to point out for series four for John, and that Knox made a similar characterization. So there's definitely some precedent there, and there's a connection between fabricated or edited stories.
I do think that at least when it comes to BBC's Sherlock and The Lying Detective.
Yeah.
And I said this earlier, but I think the mention of him being, of a mirror of him being suicidal and alone and strapped for cash, is primarily meant to call back to A Study in Pink. Because mm-hmm. a lot of those scenes with Faith are a callback to John's state. Mm-hmm. So it's about how John was really feeling in A Study in Pink, and in a way that we're not really privy to.
Yeah, it's hinted to us in some subtle ways, some not so subtle ways, depending on which country you're from.
Yeah.
It's a reference to the gun in the door, which Americans wouldn't balk at nearly or get the meaning of, but anyway, I have a note to talk about what the relevance that John Locke has to The Great Game and The Final Problem and viewing series four through that lens, because I guess I just wanted to reiterate it, that I say it's not 100% necessary to get on board with a theory about series four as a whole. But that's like the broader lens for it. But I think that's still the way that we talked about it last episode. And there's a huge discussion about the way that series four does that. And like beyond that, like the absurdist elements and Brechtian techniques, these are all hints to look further or to question what we're seeing, but they're not really telling us what the real story is. And I think there's a certain element to it, but the why did they do this with this season, is the part that you can get some meaning out of, but it doesn't a lot. I think a lot of people could still be like, but why did they have to do it this way? Or just because it's a puzzle and have fun? Like, there's always like there's a meaning to why they write this series and why they chose this direction, because they're correcting something or they're telling us what's beneath the story. There's something that we have to be looking for. Like, there's a truth that's being covered. And so what that is, you could say it's a number of things, but the more meaningful way of looking at it is through a romantic, homoerotic, subtextual, homosexual, whichever word you want to use, of subtext that's within the show, but not even just within the show, because a lot of people could look at the show as just, you know, one of the more commonly referenced examples of queerbaiting, depending on whether you agree with that or not. But I think the fact that they, like, the way that series 4 works with The Great Game, if you're using, not looking at it through that lens, you can still get meaning out of it, but it's more meaningful, I think, to reinterpret the canon, because it's not that they're creating a different version of Hollis, which we talked about off air after the our first episode, that they're not recreating a different version of Holmes. They're, by killing off the myth of Sherlock Holmes, that they're looking back at the canon and reinterpreting it and like uncovering or lifting the veil, to use a heavily loaded phrase, on the character and like the facade, and really looking at the private life of Holmes himself and like reinterpreting it. So like, this is the actual character and it's the same character and not like a different version of the character. And so before we go and really look at like Victorian era, homosexuality, views on it, subtext, a lot of phrases that they would use, you wanted to talk about Mary Watson specifically as like a, to keep with the theme on metafiction, mm-hmm. with everything.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess I can start with talking about how BBC Sherlock as a metafiction works and why it is so important to not only the understanding of the show and especially series 4, but how it relates to the historical nature of it, or the way that it relates back to history and the history surrounding Arthur Conan Doyle canon. So it shouldn't be a surprise to see the signs for how Sherlock is in fact a metafiction. A metafiction, by definition, is a type of story that is very aware of its own artifice. So there's a lot of, I mean, you just think about one of the more obvious examples being in The Abominable Bride, when we have John actually saying, within the narrative that is broadly speaking your function. So they're talking about their lives as if they are characters in a story. And this is seen throughout, even in the first episode, in the beginning, when we have Mycroft acting as sort of the author god, because he's played by Mark Gatiss, the writer. He says at the end, we need to update their status, the status of Sherlock Holmes and John Watson. So this is very...
I love, it's a genius insert of his character. Although it's funny because, like, it really doesn't get all that metafiction besides The Abominable Bride, and I guess you could say Series 4, because he's the author, and it's aware. Well, I say that just because it's definitely there. There is an element. There's a layer to it, but I don't think it's as literal, perhaps, as canon?
I think it does. I mean, it's not.
Let me explain like my perspective, and then I'll let you.
Gotcha.
I'll let you say.
Gotcha.
Okay. So like the reason why I say this, I mean, I do see it as such, and I like the Mycroft thing. Totally mm-hmm. agree, but like the I think the show, at least series 1 through 3, is the most real, quote-unquote, look into their lives that's not really through a lens, because we see John working on the blog posts, and we can read the blog posts. And even in the Great Game episode itself, they are arguing over his blog post about the episode we saw two episodes ago, his post on City in Pink. And he's mad about the way that he portrayed him, Sherlock, in that post. He doesn't feel like it's justified, or he's angry with it. And John thinks that he would have been flattered. So like, there's metafiction in that sense, but it's not so much like within the episode itself. The whole narrative is metafiction, because we're not being told the story as a story. We're told about him telling the stories, but the actual episode itself is the real thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but I'm glad you brought that up, because I mm-hmm. do something. Metafiction doesn't necessarily have to fully 100% all of the time hold on to this like veil of unreality. You can have varying degrees of unreality. And basically what I'm saying and what this means for the show is that mm-hmm. it makes sense for it to devolve into something more unreal. So, yeah. and this is something that happens in metafiction, and this maybe I can bring up something as a point to jump off that with, is that there is a reference in The Six Thatchers to a book called, potentially a reference to a book called Hawksmoor by Peter Ackroyd. And it's seen, you can see it on the wall when Sherlock goes to visit the hacker and borrow the dog Toby. And it's the only thing that's visible. So from what I know about the novel Hawksmoor, which I haven't read it, but I know some basic information, that it's a metafiction that uses the identity of there's a famous architect, and then there's a detective. So it's a detective thing, and it takes place in two different timelines. And in the beginning of the book, it's like very real. It's just sort of like every once in a while it'll shift back between the two timelines. But at the end of the book, everything gets mashed together, and the two timelines start to intertwine. So basically what this means is that sometimes metafiction does start off with a veil of reality, and it can get increasingly more absurd.
Yeah. So it's like not... there's like an element where it's like poking at the fourth wall, like drawing attention to it versus the characters actually looking at it or mm-hmm. completely knocking it down. So there's definitely there's a degree of it. Maybe.
Yes, absolutely. So I do think that Sherlock holds up as a meta fiction throughout, even though season 1 through 3 does take place in reality for the most part, I guess. It's still heightened reality, something that Amy
that's
said.
True.
In her
yeah, that's true. Meta. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's always been heightened reality.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I intuitively know these things without being able to put it into words, so mm-hmm. that's a good way to describe it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what was the point about
Mary?
Yes, we got off topic.
We did a little bit off topic.
That's okay, but it was good. Yeah.
Try to segue back to that.
Right.
So when we're thinking about Sherlock as a metafiction, one of the really important things that I think ties into the history of ACD canon is the use of Mary. And this is a potential, you know, thing that Mark Gatiss and Stephen Moffat have done with Mary. So one of the biggest questions in ACD canon was Mrs. Watson, Who is she? Is it, does Watson have five wives? Is he married
at all? Yeah, I think there's like at most was like someone guessed it was six.
Yes, because the timelines are always screwed up. Like he just sometimes Watson forgets that he has a wife and he just
doesn't or like that famous live there anymore. Example of like, oh, I don't know if this is actually a quote or if this is just a running joke, but they're like, oh yeah, and my wife is just visiting with her mother, even though Mary was an orphan.
Yes.
Which I don't even know if that's actually a reference, but it's still something that I would not be surprised to have seen it. Anyway.
Yeah, yeah. So one of the things about Mary, something that's really interesting about her character in Sherlock, is that the inconsistency of her character, of her characterization. We have her almost having multiple roles throughout season 3 and 4. And even in Tab, I guess you could say. But in series 3, she sort of starts off as this like sassy, quirky, like lady. Mm-hmm. And then she turns into this really scary, villainous person.
Femme fatale.
Yeah, she's this very femme fatale,
which is I love her introduction, because we're not introduced to her face. We're introduced to the back of her head twice.
Exactly.
I love that. We'll get to that. Anyway.
We'll get to that. And then in season 4 especially, she's all over the place. We kind of get glimpses of her being sort of scary. Like, should we be scared of her? But then she's sweet and she's almost very different than even how we were meant to see her as sweet in series 3. Like, just she's just a very different person. And then she even makes a cameo as part of John's subconscious. So she's everywhere. She's all over the place. Another thing is the inclusion of her shooting Sherlock. So the question being, did she shoot him in the heart or did she save his life? Which is something that is brought up in His Last Vow. But if you look at that from a meta-textual, like, historiographic lens, and especially if you put it through the queer subtext of the original canon, one of the theories for Mary's inconsistency in the canon, especially with a queer reading, is that she was made up. She was made up. She was a beard to conceal the nature of their relationship in order to protect them from the law, because it was illegal to be homosexual back then. So this idea that, did she shoot him in the heart or did she save him? So did she shoot him in the heart? Did she break Sherlock's heart by becoming Watson's wife? Or did she save his life? Did she save him from being criminally charged? Mm-hmm. And that's how that fits in.
And it's, because I think, and it really maintains that perspective. And I think, but the way that it's used in canon is almost, I guess, subverted in the show, because it's because of the way that she's used as such a villain. It really recontextualizes her character as a much more obvious symbol of heteronormativity and the, even like His Last Vow, like we get the image of her in her wedding gown shooting him. Mm-hmm. And The Abominable Bride itself,
just the name, which, of it.
I have a note on that. And so I will mention that later. I have a whole thing about it. But and I was gonna mention too, even with, it's so telling that the end of Six Thatchers and through Blind Detective, saying that on a DVD, on a screen, to the audience, being Sherlock and John or whoever is watching it, that he needs to go to hell, which it is layered. But then especially the most important use that's brought up again is at the end of The Final Problem, of course, where she's telling them, and she's now the voiceover, so it's not Watson, who's typically the narrator, it's Mary. because Watson's never the narrator, or John's never the narrator, really. He isn't sort of in the Abominable Bride, but he's never like a voiceover. We don't hear the blog being talked to us as like our introduction into the episode or at the close of the episode. That's a tradition that's specific to canon and like adaptations of stories, is to have Watson's like voiceover narration. And so the final problem ends on not John or Sherlock narrating, it's specifically Mary. And so her, as a symbol of all of these things that we talked about, is also very telling. And I won't get into that speech itself, because we'll be here forever. Yeah. So
I also think it's important to note that from my observation, the one thing that makes series 4 so unpleasant and unwatchable is Mary, is her role in each episode.
Yeah.
Every single time I cringe, it's because of her. I think that's really cool, just knowing the context.
Yeah, and we didn't have to either, because I was totally willing to forgive her in series 3 before I looked at it through a certain lens, because you are left with such a strong impression. So if you're not a really avid fan, like you're not really reading it with a critical eye and rewatching it, when you watch the empty hearse and then the sign of 3, you like Mary. Regardless of whether or not you want her to be there, we have no definitive reason to distrust her. You might like resent her for being there, maybe, but there's no reason to dislike her, really.
Yeah, it's not.
And so I think we're left with that impression, that first impression, and then throughout his last vow, it can lead people to be more willing to forgive. And his last vow, like the narrative function, like the way that it's structured, tricks you into thinking that we have to forgive her because of the way that it's ordered. And we know that it's misleading because of the way that Moffat described that, but we're still left with like an impression of her, and if you don't look at it critically, you could be convinced of that. And then when you relook at those early episodes, you see, oh, I don't like that, or I don't like that she had it. So if you have a very particular eye, lens, you can reinterpret a lot of the things that she says as being more manipulative. And then throughout series 4, I totally agree. That's really her stuff. Like because we're reading it in two ways, we're seeing what the narrative is trying to tell us, or like not objectively, but they're really forcing us to view her in a very particular way. But it's such a dissonance, because within that you can read like in The Six Thatchers, when Sherlock and Mary are both kind of teaming up to kind of put John down multiple times, and that stuff always gets under my skin. And then her death is another one of those moments where it's like that, like, what's the quote I always love to reference, the Brechtian quote of like, you're laughing.
You laugh when they weep. Something
and you
like
weep
that.
When they laugh.
Yes.
Yes. Because in drama, you weep when they weep and you laugh when they laugh. But in epic theater or in his works, you are supposed to weep when they laugh and laugh when they weep.
Yeah, you're supposed to feel the opposite.
Right. And it wasn't always successful. Like, he would have shows where you were supposed to laugh at something that was sad, but audiences would have the intended perspective.
The opposite. They would cry instead of he wanted them to feel alienated, but it didn't.
Right, yes. And it didn't always work. But I think that this episode in particular is very good at the general audience still thought it was sad.
Yeah, there were some people that did.
Right, but those of us, or they think that scene is stupid and melodramatic.
Yeah, I think that was kind of what most people who weren't in the know thought. Like, that was really terribly acted. What the fuck did I just watch?
Or they thought it was sad, or a mixture of both. But then we look at it as like the height of hilarity. It's so ludicrous and
It's so
absurd.
funny.
It's so funny. At the time, I don't even want to think about my first reaction to that scene. I think it probably made me a little bit sad. Like I still had like I was somewhat tricked, but there was always the entire episode, there is still that alienation feeling of like I'm just so deeply uncomfortable by what I'm watching.
I was so deeply uncomfortable. I was cringing.
Ugh.
I was like, please stop. Please make it stop. Please make it stop. Like, something else happen, please.
Yes. Anyway, we will probably be able to really get into that, I think, when we dive headfirst into series four. Oh, I don't know how we're gonna do that in a
I'm
coherent
excited.
way. I'm excited too, but we need to lay the groundwork, I think, and really prepare. Who knows if we'll actually be able to do an episode on the Six Statures if we're gonna find ourselves
We're gonna have to
taking.
watch it.
Oh, you're right. Ew.
Ew.
Yeah, I
One
think I might
episode
have
I don't
to.
watch. I
I'm definitely.
refuse.
I mean, I've said this before, but I'm definitely gonna have to take the transcript and then take detailed notes and then watch it like.
You know what? I
Like
think it'll
this,
be
and then not
okay.
pause it. I won't pause it to take notes. I'm just gonna watch it and see what I can get from that experience. And then I'll look at like screen caps, and then I'll look at the transcript and do as much as I can from there, so I don't have to prolong the experience of rewatching that episode.
God, I don't know. I mean, last time I watched it, it wasn't as bad as I thought it was. I think out of all the moments of series four that are just really hard for me to watch, the hardest scene for me to watch is the scene in The Lying Detective at the end, where John and Sherlock are talking, and Mary's there, and
Oh
it's
yeah,
because it's
it's
like,
a very particular moment of that scene that I can't watch, but
yeah, I don't see it's the whole thing because it just teeters on being truthful, and then Mary's there, and then it's like there's like just twinges of heterosexuality, and I'm like, I don't want
yeah,
it.
I know. Oh, yeah. I think I managed to distract myself enough by what's really going on in the scene, so that I don't dwell on that too much. I can, yeah, there's definitely moments where I'm cringing, but I can still sit through it. I think the Six Snatch is the least watchable because there's so many moments of like, of where it's almost real enough. It almost feels like a real episode to where makes it's
It's
that's why it's
upsetting.
uncomfortable because I'm
It's
like this
upsetting.
can't be happening and yet it is, or like her and Sherlock are laughing about something and I'm like
Oh God.
stop, she killed you.
She killed you. What are you doing?
I know, but yeah, but that's kind of the point. That's the point of the episode and I can appreciate it. It just makes the rewatch, who knows, maybe in some future where I feel better about the end of the show, I'll be able to look back at that and not feel as, I'm sure I'll still cringe, but I won't necessarily be quite as like, oh, I can't watch it, I'm
Visceral.
dying. But it's, yeah, it won't be quite as visceral.
I think it'll be okay. I think it's just like what I like to think about is noticeably, I feel like the most cringeworthy moments are the most like heterosexual. And I like to think that's not because of
Yeah.
my like bias,
Yeah,
that it's just something that everyone else experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like those
No,
moments
I
are just
do.
viscerally wrong
I
in
think
many
the Six
ways.
Statures does. I think that the Six Statures does, where you don't necessarily have to view it that way in order to come out on John's side. Like the way that they put him down multiple times in that episode and treated like the way that they treat him like a dog, they refer to him like a dog. It's very like Mary is not nice to him. through that episode. You are thin ice, lady. You're on thin ice, even on the most superficial level of reading the text. You're in thin ice. Why
can
are you
we
doing
talk
this?
About how nasty she is actually in all of series 3? In the moments where you're thinking, she's so cute. Every time she's being cute and quirky, she is being like really nasty to John, like just condescending
or manipulative. Like she's twisting things in like a way that it's just entertaining to her. Like, in every scene. Okay, like the one in the first scene we ever get from her when she's talking to John. Or no, he's trying to propose, and he says that because of her, or whatever
he says that she was the
best. Oh, you were the best thing that could have possibly happened in context to after Sherlock's death.
And she says, "Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I'm the best thing that's ever happened to you." She rewrote, but she agrees, but then she rewords it. So he says, "You're the best thing that could have possibly happened." And she says, "Yeah, I'm the best thing that's ever happened to you." And that's not what he said.
No,
you were the best
all.
Thing that could have happened after the death of when I was really depressed. Like, she was the best thing that could have happened. And she says, "Yeah, I'm the best thing that's ever happened to you." And that's not at all what he was saying. And yeah, that is just, and even the face he has after that moment too, where he's like, oh, like presumptuous, huh? Like he has like a look on his face, like, oh, okay. He's very taken aback by that comment. But then we never get to see the close to that, like the way that he goes back to the proposal, because then that's when they're kind of interrupted. So,
and that's the one thing I want to mention is that in series 3, even the moments where where people find her likable, she's actually being nasty in all of those scenes. But in series 4, for the most part, she's not behaving like that. She's behaving very differently. Sometimes she does. When Sherlock and Mary are getting the dog and she's like, dumb or whatever. I don't know what she says exactly. But if that was Sherlock that said it.
They were both joking about it together.
Yeah, but for the most part, I feel like in series 4, Mary is acting more kind, and it's off-putting.
Yeah, like the doting mother, because she's dead kind
of
idea.
But like, even when she was alive, like, do you remember the letter that she wrote to John and was reading it? It was so barfy.
Ugh, yeah, it was very like, I just don't buy this coming from her. Because we don't really get those moments from them. We get a couple random comments where they're sort of smiley and sweet at each other, but
they didn't seem in love whatsoever.
No, it's mostly like, it's showing that they're in a comfortable relationship, quote unquote comfortable relationship, but they're not like lovey-dovey. And then we get so much of them in his last vow of them never getting along, almost an entire episode. There's a couple moments of levity, and then it's mostly them not liking each other and her just being nasty and resentful of him. Really would have spent his time with Sherlock. And then of course there's the reveal that she's a villainous character in that episode too.
Yes. And at the end, when John supposedly is about to forgive her, and she just did something horrible to him. That is like one of the worst things you could do to somebody that you love. And yeah, he doesn't speak to her for 6 months, and she's all nasty about it. No shit, he's not going to speak to you for 6 months.
Yeah, really?
What did you expect?
Oh, and then, I love the comment. Oh, I really can't speak to this because I can't remember. I have to like go back and watch the episode where she's talking to, I think it was Sherlock's father or mother. One of the two. And was talking about her being like the sane one. Something.
Yeah.
And she was like, oh, no, like implying that, no, I'm not really all that sane. I'm kind of crazy, because she's a little psychopathic, to be honest. Not literally. I won't make that conclusion, and we don't really know. But honestly, I was just thinking as we were talking that the lying detective when it's not even her, is the more, other than like what's on her on the tape, other than that, like her as John's subconscious, that's the most, like the only way I can stomach Mary.
She's actually likable when she was John's subconscious.
Because it's not her.
Exactly. Which is why it's so cool, because typically I can't stand her. But now mm-hmm. I like her. So it's not, I don't think that's necessarily my bias, you know, if I'm liking her in this scene.
Yeah, and I think that's the narrative technique there, because we are being we're recontextualizing her character. We're led to believe, we're viewing her through a very particular lens, and that's John's subconscious. Literally, as a text, the whole thing, the whole series being rewritten sort of through his perspective, it's doctored footage, but also that episode itself, we know, we're told surface level that it's Mary as John, like he's imagining that she's there, she's talking to him in his head, but really it's just his subconscious. So it's very surface level that it's, we're viewing her through his lens, whether that's he's looking at her as like this Mother Mary martyr, perfect wife, mother figure, or that's the narrative like on purpose as like her as a figure, like meant to mislead the audience. Whichever way you want to look at it, it's pretty obvious that we're being told that this is Mary and what she would think, rather than that's actually her.
So do you want to segue back into the historical?
That was a long tangent, but it was a good one. We're definitely going to have to put a pin in a lot of these arguments. I actually put one of our episode ideas as being all about her, because there's mm-hmm. so much to unpack. But we'll get to it as we get to season 3 and 4, et cetera. But anyway, the idea of like what Mary Watson was as a character in canon is what we originally wanted to segue into. Talking about like the Victorian era and like their views on homosexuality and the way that it was viewed in media, how much people knew about it or mm-hmm. how it was referenced. And what we mostly have is like private diaries or legal records, or we have newspapers that might have detailed certain events, or we have like literature at the time, so poetry, novels, plays, that would reference things in the culture. There's a subculture of homosexuality in London specifically. The things that people know to signal to each other. There's two texts that I bought, because I'm crazy, have not read through the whole thing like in detail, but there's sections that I looked at specifically, but I'm referencing London and the Culture of Homosexuality, 1885 to 1914 by Matt Cook, and mostly referencing Strangers, Homosexual Love in the 19th Century by Graham Robb. So probably, Carrie, you've probably seen like the meta about mm-hmm. these things, so I mm-hmm. looked at them to see what I could reference. Some things are very similar to what was in that meta, and I will link it so people don't have to go and buy the book. I will link those, and then I'll refer to certain quotes, and so they might overlap, or I could be referencing something that wasn't mentioned in any of those posts. But there are some phrases that are mentioned in both of these that are significant to the culture. There's certain terms, like they didn't necessarily use the term homosexual. And if it was in existence, it wasn't all the time, or it was like, they used a lot of euphemistic language. So they would refer to sodomy, indecency, indecent acts. Inverts is a common one. So they would refer to inversion or someone being an invert. And then there was a lot of references to places and cues, I guess. So it really goes into like how broadly in culture they viewed it. So like they would reference, there's one particular book or a pamphlet, I think maybe, about like how to identify a homosexual, because everyone was concerned with, not everyone, but a lot of people were concerned with how to spot someone, and they were rarely accurate, but then there was this idea that, like, well, they always know mm-hmm. who each other, like, who they are and how to identify themselves to someone else like them without making it so obvious that someone, an average person, would know. So there was, like, an obsession with trying to figure it out. And they relied a lot, of course, on stereotypes, which is what a lot of people still do. But then there's a lot of things that we know of now. So there's, like, Molly houses, which is important, and we'll get to that. There's, before the trial of Oscar Wilde, there was the famous Cleveland Street Scandal. And there were certain known areas of London that were known to have people live there, or they would go to bars, or they would hang out in parks, or public bathrooms was often a place. There's so many references to blackmailing. Blackmailing is throughout both of these books, so many references.
I think that, is that specifically the blackmailing that happened after that specific act was passed? There was an act, it was the Criminal Law Act, or Law Amendment Act, which was passed in 1885. This was the specific act that sent Oscar Wilde to prison.
Yeah, that's a big one, because he wasn't, like, I get dates and names of things very confused, so I don't really know. But so he, in the introduction, or like the first chapter, they make it explicit that there was the idea of sodomy, and like you could be killed for that for a long time. But he wasn't charged with sodomy, it was indecency, or gross indecency, or acts of indecency, or whatever it was. And they were very similar.
I think it's because sometimes they couldn't necessarily prove that somebody engaged in right. that specific
yeah.
Sexual act. And something I did a little tiny bit of research after finding about Peter Ackroyd, because he also wrote history books. And one of the books that he wrote was called Queer City, Gay London from the Romans to the Present Day. And I read a teeny bit of the beginning, and mostly he went into this idea that the understanding of homosexuality was not the same as it is today. Mm-hmm. And even the word sodomy wasn't necessarily exclusively used for homosexual acts. Same with buggery and yes. other words that they used. Sometimes they would call homosexual men like perverts, but they also called other people perverts.
They definitely detail who he goes through, because Graham Robb specifically, his perspective is very much like, it's not as bleak as you might think, which is telling it what audience he's writing for, because it was bleak. It just wasn't quite as bleak as we might be led to believe, because not literally everyone was killed. Like, the percentage of people that were killed it wasn't like this mass genocide as you could potentially start to think. And so he does talk about the cases that we do know of where people were killed. He says that there was usually a couple random cases, and then there would be like one huge case of like 26, 27 people that were found, and only really a few of them were either convicted or were actually killed. But it was usually like these big, huge scandals, and then it would go away for a while. But yeah, it wasn't it. And if it wasn't sodomy, it was really when the later in history, when you get into it, where if they weren't convicted of the crime of sodomy specifically, there was usually something else that was after that, which is why Wilde was convicted of indecent acts or gross indecency or whatever it was. Or they were, regardless of conviction or not, their lives were completely destroyed. So there was an element of that that's inevitable. But whether they were actually killed is not as pervasive. But that's kind of irrelevant to what we're getting at, because it was still fairly bleak, just not as bleak. And there's also an interesting perspective throughout it, the way that doctors viewed it, because it was before psychology really came to be, or really took over that, like, figuring out where it came from. Doctors were allowed to, and it was this one really interesting message that I got about how it was actually, homosexuality was a really almost lucrative field of study, supposedly, because there was nothing on it. If you wanted to make a name for yourself, that's where people would be likely to look into figuring it out. none of them were really successful at all, literally at all, but that's, they would publish things with conclusions that later were contradicted or weren't useful at all, but they still did it. It was almost elite. Like you were trying to be ahead of the science or at the top of your field or at the front of it. So it wasn't entirely looked down on for a doctor to be really interested in these mm-hmm. sorts of things. For someone else, they didn't have that quote unquote privilege, supposedly. So that's interesting to think about when we're talking about like Doyle's views on it, the way that he could talk about it, and Watson himself as well.
Yeah, and I also think one day we should do an episode on Arthur Conan Doyle and
his life.
There's a lot of interesting information about Arthur Conan Doyle.
He's very fascinating. There's so much about him that's not even relevant to Sherlock Holmes, really. He's just a fascinating person.
He's a very weird guy. He was a weird guy. There is one thing specifically I'm not going to go into because maybe I'll save it for later. But it made me think of the Black Diaries. Do you remember seeing that post about the Black Diaries? So I'll go into this very quickly, but there was a case where there was a government official who was being tried for doing treason or something like that, and a lot of the things they were accusing him from were from these diaries that he had, and they called them the Black Diaries. And in a lot of these diaries there was detailed accounts of him having sexual encounters with men from wherever it was he was traveling to. And supposedly, Arthur Conan Doyle had some sort of say in this. Apparently, one of the defenses that they gave was that, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was interested to know about sexual perversion in the Amazon, and that he wanted diaries to be written. I'm like, so this guy just wrote porn for him. It's very weird.
That's right. I think there is a reference to that. At least the Amazonian reference. It is in the back in his last chapter. We'll come back to that. We'll see if whatever it comes up. I'm just gonna go through these books and look at like the little, I have like little tabs, and I'll just look at the ones that I'm not expected to, I'm not gonna pull all this from memory. So there was a huge, which I can't remember having known about this before, but there was a lot of references to, obviously, the Cleveland Street Scandal, which briefly I'll go into that. It was basically like, I don't know if this is the same one, but I know that was supposed to be like a bar or a brothel that was raided, and a lot of people were arrested and implicated. It was like 1881, I want to say, maybe 89. I don't remember exactly the year, but I do know that it was referenced, and I did not know this, but it was referenced in Picture of Dorian Gray, which I thought was really interesting. That was one of the things that they found in his trial. They referenced in Picture of Dorian Gray, and where he alluded to the scandal, and I didn't know that. I don't know if this is the same case, but I know there was if not the same one, there was a similar one of like this bar brothel, like it was called the White Swan, where people would go, and it was very successful, and there was a lot of them that were pretty successful and they weren't in that much danger, but that one particular one was raided. It wasn't just a brothel, but it was like they performed marriages there. Yeah, and it was like particularly scary to read about the way that they were treated in trial. Like the owners were pilloried. Do you know what that is? That's when, like, I think that's when they're put on, like, those
medieval things called. To stick their hands.
Look up a picture if you're listening to this. I don't want to. Yeah, and I can't even, like, remember the exact details, but the crowds of just angry mobs, just, they were brutal and almost unrecognizable after that. And if they weren't, and then I think they were killed after that, or they were sent to prison, or one or the other. I have to look up, but I would just look up that particular case and look into some of the horrifying ways that they were treated. This book at the beginning, I knew about about Molly houses. Mm-hmm. Molly houses is another term for like a brothel of where homosexual people would go. They were referred to as mollies, like the people that would go there, like gay people were called mollies, referred to as that. This particularly, I didn't know this was a popular thing, but it mentions so many times, Kara. It mentions St. James's Park, and which I'm like, my first thought of St. James's Park is in The Empty Hearse. That whole huge scene takes place in St. James's Park. Or St. James the Less, they mention in like the text, remember? And that's where they go. It's like, I can't forget that. And it's constantly referenced. Like, Wilde lived on the street nearby, or like on that street. And so many of them did. So St. James's Park, so this is a quote, and the area around it were mentioned especially frequently. St. James's Square and Pall Mall. Oh, the Royal Oak on the corner of St. James's Square and the Molly House in the 1720s, complete with a private chapel for mock marriages. So this was a thing that existed. I think that's the one I was referencing, where they would have mock marriages. And I think one of the owners was a priest, if I'm not mistaken. And then there's another quote here of someone had written, the grand jury of Middlesex wrote to the Home Secretary urging that St. James's Park should be locked at night to forestall, quote, that most detestable and abominable crime. And the word abominable is used multiple times. They talk a lot about it. And then this is another poem, A View of the Town in 1735. But it says, he to St. James's Park with rapture flies. Mm. So he to St. James's Park with rapture flies. Like, he's fleeing to St. James's Park. And roams in search of some vile ingle prize, courts the foul pathic in the fair one's place, and with unnatural lust defiles his race, the great metropolis of England's isle, and this is the part I circled, had like to have been the nation's funeral pile.
Oh,
which, a funeral pile is like... Yeah. And so I think that just, I couldn't help but read that and think of that scene in The Empty Hearse when he's going to St. James's Park.
In a literally pile. On a motorcycle. He's like under a literal fast, pile.
And then John is under... Yes, and they're burning Guy Fawkes, who, if you don't know the history of Guy Fawkes, he had attempted to blow up Parliament. So it's like, it's a very common practice on the anniversary of that night to remember the 5th of November to burn Guy Fawkes. And then we have the connection of him to John, who's underneath all of that. So they're constantly looking down on St. James's Park. And I just think, wow, the image of when I read that, of he to St. James's Park with rapture flies, is like, there's definitely, if you make a connection to it, of this poem and this idea of thinking of St. James's Park in that scene, it really, especially given that we have who set that up, who put together this trap, was Magnuson, Charles Augustus Magnuson, who, the blackmailer, right? And it's just like, oh my god, that says enough. I just had my feelings on this, but
based off of the historical context and everything, it is putting maybe more context to that line in The Empty Hearse when Sherlock comes back from the dead and he says, interesting thing, a tuxedo lends distinction to friends and anonymity to waiters. Which is a reference to a book. I forget what the book is called, but it is an old gay book from the 50s, I think.
Yeah.
Yes, which Mark has read and has admitted that he referenced that purposefully. And in that scene, a guy is talking about, he wishes that he could just be gay publicly and be affectionate publicly without scrutiny. And that is what that line is about. So, I don't know. Interesting. It's an interesting place to put it there.
Speaking of that scene, because I remember Mycroft mentioned that the restaurant, I can't remember the name of the restaurant, but it was on Marylebone Road. And St. Mel is referenced in here. So in literally the exact next page, they mention, there's a lot of places that are mentioned. So the area to go, or it's talked about, is the West End. So there's a mention to Piccadilly. So Piccadilly is it square or circus?
Piccadilly Circus.
Yeah. And then there was White Lion Tavern in the Haymarket, something. There was a pamphlet saying there were various houses in the metropolis used by such wretches for their nefarious purposes, especially in the neighborhood of St. Marylebone. Yeah, I know. And then further down is when they talk about an analysis of arrests and prosecutions, etc. So further activity, because quote, further activity in the West End, in Hyde Park, Green Park, Piccadilly, Soho, Covent Garden, and the Strand. And so there's Fleet Street, Strand, and Charing Cross also. And that comes up again later. It's another, it gives more context to the picture of Dorian Gray. And I'll get to that. Ives, George Ives, I believe that's a reference to, poet, who he, in this book, by Matt Cook, he references a lot of George Ives, like his diaries, and I'll get to that later. Ives noted that the Criterion Bar on Piccadilly Circus was a great center for inverts. So I believe, if I'm not mistaken, we are introduced to Watson at the beginning in the Criterion Bar.
Yes. Yes, that's where he meets with
Yes.
Stanford in the original books.
In the unaired pilot, which we'll talk about next time, that's where it actually takes place. And I think it may be even in the Abominable Bride. I'd have to double check. But I know that in the unaired pilot, we open to him, not in some random park, but in Piccadilly Circus. And that's what we're showed. And then we see John walking up, and then that's when they go to a bar or a restaurant and sit down. And it's not named such, but it is still a reference to that scene in the canon, and they do go to the Criterion Bar. Oh, and there's another, they also go into lifting the veil on Vice. There's not a whole lot to talk about in this, but if we're talking about heavily the abominable crime, as I quoted earlier, for the Abominable Bride, it's a very specific word choice that I don't think the bride or even the women in the episode were particularly abominable, other than, like, obviously murder. But I don't know if we would necessarily associate the two as being abominable, but I think it's just a very specific word choice. Given other context, it just sits more heavily. But the idea of wearing a veil or lifting the veil. And we see Moriarty do that too, and it's a whole thing. But anyway, this says in here, quote, during the Cleveland Street scandal, the Star, a newspaper, admitted its reticence in dragging into the light of day and topics of conversation the foul, loathsome, slimy things that are hidden out of sight, but announced that the time had come to break the silence, to lift the veil and expose the men involved to the view of justice. So that's that, yeah.
Wow.
Heavy, heavy stuff. And then they also, it goes into a lot of just references to blackmailers, just so much of them. So large numbers, they would be on the lookout for people too. And not everyone in politics, like in or government or police, they hated blackmailers, but they also like didn't agree with people that they were blackmailing, but they didn't agree with blackmailing itself, and they couldn't really catch blackmailers. Certain blackmailers are almost as known, in quotations, as politicians or actors, only the witnesses and victims will not come forward. So certain blackmailers, Milverton and Magson, are really known.
Uh-oh.
Almost as known as politicians or actors, but the witnesses and victims won't come forward, because why would they, right? It's so, can't reference everything, but that's a strongly worded one that just really, ugh. Magnuson, they did a good job with him.
Yeah, they really did. Oh, he was so creepy. And I just think about the deleted scene.
Oh, that's right. It's deleted. I forgot about that.
Yeah, it's the only deleted scene, I think, that is available watch from Sherlock. And it's the scene where Magnuson is being very predatory.
And he talks about his hands. He's got a very particular fascination with his hands.
Yes, and he says Sherlock has a woman's hands.
Yes, which is a very telling, because in Graham Rob's novel, he details things that people would use to identify homosexuals, and having an elegant hand or a woman's hand or soft hand or warm skin, like all these feminine qualities were always used to certain, probably blackmailers. This is another reference to, like I was saying before, about like the West End, Piccadilly Circus, and St. James's Park, etc., etc. Henley, so a former friend of Wilde's, talked about it in The Observer, and then he says, Henley, quote, like the counsel for the prosecution in the Wilde trials, 5 years later, was able to identify the hints at homosexual desire in the novel and connect them, so that's Picture Dorian Gray, to the Cleveland Street scandal, which had erupted a year earlier. The novel is not explicit, but the obsession Basil and Lord Henry have with Dorian, the gaps and silences around many of Dorian's exploits, the trail of ruined young men, the circuit of places, and even the choice of an ancient Greek name for the protagonist. There is a picture of, oh my goodness, my cat. I was not expecting that. Okay, hello. his nails are digging into my leg. Oh, all right.
What a pleasant surprise.
Anyway, so he says, the picture of Dorian Gray, in particular, the imperatives of time are evaded. And he says, there is a sense of timelessness as the ever-youthful Dorian explores the city. So the city is referenced a lot. There's an idea of the city and the self being connected. It's like the city is, and the imagery to talk about the city is referred to as an idea of talking about the self. The early part of Picture Dorian Gray that focuses on Lord Henry, his aesthetic tastes and his West End circuit. So he goes on a stroll. He says he begins in St. James's, which had long-standing associations with homosexual activity and was known in the 1880s and 1890s for its homosocial club life, bachelor chambers, and the London and provincial Turkish baths in Jermyn Street, if I'm pronouncing that right. Henry crosses Piccadilly, and then he visits an uncle in the, quote, bachelor chambers, and then he goes to Soho, and then he goes... And in outlining this walk, Wilde touched on a secretive map of the city without revealing its precise associations. It would have been available to some, but not all of the novel's readers. So he has the character walk through the West End. And you can, I believe, Soho. Is it the same thing as, like, Chinatown, basically?
Soho?
Yeah.
I don't think Soho is Chinatown.
I don't think they're exactly the same either, but I want to say it's nearby.
I think Soho is, I don't know.
I should have looked this up before.
I don't live in London. I don't know.
I was in London at the time, and I do remember being in Piccadilly Circus and not being far from. We literally stumbled upon Chinatown. I didn't mean to go there.
I don't know. I'm like,
I guess it's not.
It's probably not. I think Soho is a separate neighborhood. It might be just close by.
Yeah.
That's how cities are. Like, you cross the street and you're in a different neighborhood.
Anyway, but that's the idea. So the West End is a very particular reference. But, like, St. James is especially an important name that constantly gets referenced. It was notoriously known.
That's new. I never...
I didn't know this until I looked through here. So I'm glad I went through this one and I didn't just stick with strangers because I would have missed this. Wilde depicts an intricate relationship between the city and the self. Something about that phrase just caught my attention. But I have so many more important references, and I will just make a quick reference. So in the epilogue of this, Matt Cook references a lot of the writings of George Ives, and he goes into a lot of detail on this guy's life. He spent a lot of time researching and writing his life, researching and writing, and he wrote down what happened. He had a diary that covers 1886 to 1950. He had 122 volumes, and he details, like, extensive notes on his friendships with Carpenter, Wilde, Lord Alfred Douglas, etc., etc. Commentary on scandals, major public events. He religiously collected accounts of court proceedings involving heterosexuality. He had reports of cricket matches, chess games, eccentric human behavior, all things Greek. He It says in the late 1880s and early 1890s, I've self-consciously assumed the mantle of independent West End bachelor. Bachelor is an important term. If you lived as a bachelor, you were usually someone with means, but it was expected to marry. So if you lived as a bachelor, it was an odd thing to do at the time. But it's a loaded word if you're referring to someone as a bachelor, which will come up. He took chambers at St. James's Street. A lot of them lived there. Let me skip ahead to the important part that I wanted to mention. He always had a very keen aesthetic sense. He associated his strong tendency to Orientalisms directly to his desires. Aside from this self-examination, Ives described himself as the Sherlock Holmes of a 1,000 little peculiarities.
Ooh.
If only you could see Kira's wide-eyed, like, oh, what? I know, when I read that, I immediately bookmarked it. I would wager a guess, an educated guess, that people read Sherlock Holmes and recognized themselves in his character. Anyway, going over to Strangers, Homosexual Love in the 19th Century, which by Graham Robb, I really recommend this. It's the most readable of the two books I've been mentioning. This is the one that's the most readable. It's really good. There's so much in this that's not, and I tried to just focus on what was the most relevant, so I wouldn't be here all day. The most eye-opening and, oh my goodness, parts where everything he's had to say about Wilde and obviously Sherlock Holmes. He has a whole chapter on detectives and the idea of a detective, which we'll get to that. Let me skip ahead, see what's important. So first, talking about Wilde, Oscar Wilde is the most famous case of, and what do you, because I know I've heard of this before, where people have made comparisons between his trial and the one in the Reichenbach Fall. So what comes to mind to you?
What comparisons?
Yeah.
In the episode?
Yeah.
There's a few, I think, notable ones that I remember. One of them is the place that he has tried it. It's I think at Queensbury. I think that's what it's called, the place. I'm not really sure. This is just coming out of my brain.
Oh.
Another one is the Richard Brooke. There was somebody in the trial named Richard Brooke, which,
oh, I didn't know that.
Something similar to Richard Brooke, which was the alias that Moriarty uses in the episode. Another thing is the position. Yeah, the position that Sherlock was in was similar, the same one that Oscar Wilde was in. I don't remember if it was the plaintiff or something.
Like visually?
No, I think like the role in the court was the same. I think it was like the plaintiff, or I don't remember.
Oh.
But I remember it being slightly unexpected.
Yeah. Well, the Richard Brooke thing is interesting. So you mentioned Queensbury, and I don't know if that is a place. The section that I'm reading, it opens on the 18th of February, 1895. The paranoid Marquis of Queensbury, whose son, Lord Alfred Douglas, was Oscar Wilde's lover. So the Marquis of Queensbury set a booby trap, Wilde's expression, by leaving a card at a club for Oscar Wilde. And unwisely, Wilde decided to sue for criminal libel because he said, the note said, for Oscar Wilde, posing sodomite. Or it was a misspelling of it, but yeah. And so
He spelled it wrong. I remember it because he was
illiterate. I think that's why you said he was in a similar position.
Yes, Queensbury was the name of the dude.
Yeah, so he's.
So I forget what the place was called, though, but it's held at the same courthouse.
The Old Bailey?
So it wasn't, yeah.
I think it was Old Bailey. The Old Bailey. It's mentioned a few times in here.
Yes, it was the Old Bailey.
Yeah. And so it says, I think the trial went from like April 5th until May something. May 25th, and 1895, which is an important time period.
Oh, and I do remember another detail that they put in Sherlock is there is a mention somewhere of how Oscar Wilde behaved right before he was arrested.
Yeah.
And then he very gently, like, put his coat and his gloves and his scarf on or something. And Sherlock does the exact same thing when he's about to be arrested.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I remember that. Okay, I'm glad you are here because I would not have remembered that. So, because I'm really, like, overly focused on what was written here. But it's interesting he really emphasizes that the way things turned out was a tragedy because it could have ended better. He had opportunities to avoid the sentence and hard labor because he was a very prominent figure. And he had money and he could have left the country. So he was arrested and charged. The jury failed to reach a verdict, but he was released on bail and still refused to leave England. He could have found a way to leave and people urged him to, but he wouldn't do it. Eventually he was at the second trial, he was found guilty. Yeah. So it says here that the quote, "the sad and avoidable sequence of events is still the biggest single influence on perceptions of Victorian homosexuality. In the repercussions, the Wilde trials belonged more to the 20th century than to the 19th. So he's thought of as a charismatic martyr, but really it was not his own doing, but to the degree that he was punished, he could have avoided it if he was, getting from the perspective of this author, and that's his view, that it's sad, but he possibly could have avoided as serious of an end. And I don't think it was on purpose. Like, I don't think he purposely sabotaged his trial. He was just being himself.
And yeah, I think
something, and that's important to note, because I think there was a lot to Sherlock in the episode too. He wasn't trying to sabotage anything.
Yeah, I was about to say, it's really interesting you say that, because Sherlock also was behaving very himself.
Yes, right.
So parallels there.
This is a really good, important quote. So it said, "Wilde may have been crucified on the cross of public morality, but he supplied the hammer and the nails. Before and after his arrest, he was given every chance to leave the country, but ignored the advice of friends and lawyers. In court, he improvised brilliantly, but he also lied stupidly and antagonized his prosecutors by hinting that they were too low to appreciate his art." And yeah. Holmes talks about deduction as an art as well as a science. There's a lot of references to that. "Wilde had made a brilliant career of poking fun at English society and did nothing to apologize for his success. Yeats pointed out the rage against Wilde was so complicated by the British's jealousy of the art and the artist. This hatred is not due to This hatred is not due to any action of the artist or the eminent man. It is merely the expression of an individual hatred and envy become collective because circumstances have made it so."
Wow.
Yeah. And I think that's largely analogous to everything that happened in The Reichenbach Fall, except it has nothing to do with indecency, but like fraud.
It's still about defaming him and his name. That's sort of where the parallel is his reputation is being destroyed.
Oh, there's more things I could point out, but I would be here forever. Okay, let's talk about the biggest important part where there's a whole chapter on the heroes of modern life. So he talks about the eccentric amateur sleuth, and he first decides to talk about Edgar Allan Poe. The eccentric amateur sleuth was introduced in 1841, The Murders of Rue Morgue. So this is very interesting. I didn't know anything about this before I read this chapter, because I think when I've read Meta, people talk about the Sherlock Holmes aspects and they skip over this, but I think this is still really important, especially after series 4. It says that it's very, like, not that they were referencing it, but it's like a common theme that people will tend to do with detective stories. So readers were invited by Poe to send in coded messages, which Poe then solved, all except one, which turned out to be meaningless. His own cipher remained unsolved, despite the enticement of a year's subscription to the magazine. And then The Murders in the Rue Morgue was another test to the reader's cryptic skills. So the story itself. The first part of the tale is a detailed exposition of Dupont's analytical methods, but it was also an invitation to apply the methods to the tale itself, to distinguish the large and irrelevant from the small and significant. The necessary knowledge, says Dupont, is that of what to observe. And then he goes on to describe the enigmatic detective or amateur sleuth as very telling, like that's how he perceives his character, because he says he goes out only at night, and he, despite having satisfied his creditors, because he was in debt, I think he had to pay off his debts, he's curiously vigilant, and the narrator is someone who meets him, the sleuth, and he describes like meeting him as if it was love at first sight. So he's very wow. enraptured with this sleuth, and they would go out at night. And there's another reference of these two men. It says, and keeping the shutters closed at night might not sound suspicious today, but it certainly did in 1841. And then it also goes back to reference Wilde. So someone cross-examining Wilde about his visits to Alfred Taylor, he always kept a double set of curtains drawn. So it's a weighted, and the idea of keeping the shutters closed or the curtains closed. And I read that and I immediately thought of that one scene. I knew you know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
In The Sign of Three. Behind closed curtains. Wonder who started that rumor. Oh, I know. Painful. Ugh. Okay. Whew.
And then I don't know if there's any parallel to the fact that Sherlock says a bunch of times the curtain rises.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, ouch. I love that, but oh man. Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. I didn't think of that. Yeah, so this is just like one of the early references of, and whether it was done consciously or not, there is something inherent about being a detective where you can easily make those comparisons for the time period anyway. He talks about two wild things that are alive in the city. One of them has a very large hands, tawny hair, and the strength of a lunatic. The other is a nocturnal creature with heightened senses and unusual mating habits. So there's a mention to like an ape in the story, and that's why there's a comparison between him and an ape. So nocturnal, heightened senses, unusual mating habits, which is
that's weird.
Yeah, that's weird. All right, let me skip ahead. And so he says, before he goes in to talk about Sherlock Holmes, he gives an introduction and says, the following observations are not a sly attempt to ensnare the great detective in an elastic web of gay revisionism. Everyone already knows instinctively that Holmes is a homosexual. And I want to highlight the word instinctively, regardless of whether it's intentional or not. There is
an instinctual belief of that. Yes.
And he goes on to mention the private life, which we can get to later, but I'll skip ahead, because he says, it goes on to talk about like how Sherlock Holmes bears a resemblance to Oscar Wilde in looks, which is pretty clear as well. And it talks about how Oscar Wilde and Doyle met at a meeting. Oh, and then, yeah, this is the reference to the Black Dyers that you had mentioned earlier. They had met each other. Doyle still remembered, 35 years later, Doyle still remembered that golden evening. Wilde's conversation had left an indelible expression. His curious precision of statement, the delicate flavor of humor. He towered above us all. He had, in effect, been dining with Sherlock Holmes. So there's a interesting connection, wow. Like a striking resemblance, it says. He does look a lot like him. Especially, I think, the show, with the way that they made his hair, which isn't Ben's hair.
Huh.
He doesn't wear his hair like that ever, but they make him look more like Oscar Wilde than he ever did in the stories.
It's funny that you mentioned that. I remember Benedict Cumberbatch having said something about how he hates wearing his hair like that because he feels like a woman. So,
oh my God. It's so short, though. Come on.
No, seriously, but...
Whatever.
Whatever.
Oh, no, yeah.
Interesting that it makes him
feel... It is. Yeah. And he talks about, like, a true decadent, Holmes enjoys introspective German music and listens to it with languid, dreamy eyes. Art for art's sake is one of his mottos, applied not to poetry, but to the incongruously useful art of criminal detection. And so, like, that's connecting back to Wilde on Trial and the reference to his art. There's a jealousy there. Mm-hmm. So, very clear comparison to what he does. Oh, it says the Diogenes Club, explains Holmes, the queerest club in London, and Mycroft, one of the queerest men, which is interesting. The word didn't have the same,
didn't have the same
direct meaning, but it is still, you know, an interesting description, regardless.
Still, it still connotes the strangeness, which I think
which is why that word came to mean what it does today, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah.
And then it talks about the feminization, sort of, like the softer human emotions. Because it's a set in Study in Scarlet, when Watson praises him for making criminal detection an exact science, Holmes flushed up with pleasure at my words and the earnest way in which I uttered them. I had already observed that he was as sensitive to flattery on the score of his art as any girl could be of her beauty. Very
classic.
Very, very, yes. and I love what he says. This is Graham Robb. In his own words, says, happily, Mrs. Watson never materializes and has the grace to be dead by 1904.
Yes!
Which I thought that was so, like, savage. I love it. So nice. Oh, and then he, of course, mentions Gerdibs. Whew, which I don't think we have time to get into, but we will touch on it. Because inevitably, we will be talking about Gerdibs. He mentions the giant rat of Sumatra, for which the world is not yet prepared. He mentions that they had both the Avenue Turkish baths, for which both Holmes and I had a weakness. The Turkish baths was a known place, just like, you know, Piccadilly Circus and St. James's Square. That was a common place to go.
It's interesting that you say that. I want to mention something. This is so stupid and off topic, sort of, but not really. I'm just thinking about, like, the quote of him saying that everyone innately knows that Sherlock Holmes is gay, right?
Yes. Or intuitively, I think is the word he used.
Yeah, intuitively, that's right. This is so stupid. There's actually a scene from, and this is funny because this is such an awful show, but, like, there's a scene in Family Guy where they mention they have Sherlock for, like, a second, or Sherlock Holmes, and they make a mention of him being gay because he knows about bathhouses. And it's just like, if this, like, edgelord can say that Sherlock Holmes is gay, like, come on. And then everyone knows. It's
obvious. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But no one will say it seriously.
Yeah. It's like, it's only ever mentioned like this when it's done in a joking way.
As a joke.
No one ever takes it seriously. It's frustrating as hell.
Except for Billy Wilder.
Of course.
Thank you, Wilder.
Thank you.
As they said. Okay, and so they go, he finishes by not just talking about Holmes, but of the idea of, like, common archetypes of characters who have, like, the mask, the sleuthing, or, like, a sidekick, the dynamic duo, which in itself, it literally is the dynamic, but it all goes back to the most prominent version of Holmes and Watson. But he mentions the Lone Ranger and his uncannily perceptive sidekick Tonto, the dynamic duos, etc. Batman and Robin. It's like that double life idea. He doesn't say this, but I'm saying it, like, that there's that double life aspect where they live as Bruce Wayne and Dick Grayson, but also cruise the slimy streets of Gotham City nervously disguised and dressed in tights. So there's that, like, crime fighting, that sleuthing at night in darkened corners, but they live like a double lives. And that's that, and which is why it's no surprise to me that there's that, I think it's the George Clooney version of Batman. You know what I'm talking about?
Is that the one that Tim Burton directed?
Yeah, that's the bad one. I think it's the, they're all kind of bad, but it's the most campy one. Like when George Clooney's Batman is talked about as being bad, but it's really just campy. And it's not, it doesn't take the superhero detective as seriously as later versions of the, of Batman do, but it's very campy. And I think that the director or George Clooney himself or both played Batman as gay, even if it's not directly obvious on screen. But it's really no surprise when I read this. I was like, yeah, that checks out.
It was Batman and Robin.
Yeah, that see, that makes even more sense to me. So Rob says, quote, "The wearing of masks, the streetwise reading of signs, the ability to operate in different milieu. These were the qualifications of the urban homosexual and the private detective." So reading signs, streetwise, wearing masks. Like, that's the intuitive comparison that we can make, regardless of whether the characters literally on page are intended to have been written a certain way or not. Someone's going to pick it up. And I think with Batman and Robin, that's a classic case where it's an interpretation and it makes a lot of sense. Just slightly different from Holmes, but.
So basically, be gay, solve crimes.
Yes. Instead of like do crime?
Be gay, do crimes.
Yes, do crimes. But in this case, it's be gay, solve crimes. I love it. So the astounding commercial success of The Homosexual Detective represents a kind of recuperation of the scapegoat by an apparently homophobic society. In the dream world of literature, the scapegoat was not only readmitted to society, he was idolized and imitated. So it's a good scapegoat, which is really telling, because you've got, like, Dr. Conan Doyle. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle is a doctor, too. And he's got an excuse and one element, and then you also have Holmes himself living with his sidekick. But they're solving crimes. He's doing all these strange things, but he's doing that in order to, you know, live a life under, without suspicion. Like, there's a reason why he's doing it. He's solving crimes. He can't be bad. He's catching the people that are doing all these strange, nefarious things, and he's catching them. So it's a scapegoat in that way. And I just, like, popped in my head, I just remembered the I don't think it was in here, but I think it was in the other book where they talk about how it was really common for people to take up the habit of smoking to put people off the scent. And if they could grow a mustache, they would grow a mustache. So that's literally Holmes and Watson right there. I don't know why that just popped in my head, but it did.
That's crazy.
I loved this. Look, this right at the end, so I'm almost done. He says, "The acquired habit of avoiding detection and identifying fellow homosexuals, there's an innate quality." So there's like this fascination of by sexologists or the average person by identifying someone who is a homosexual. So there's pseudo-informative works called, like, there's one, How to Recognize Homosexuals, serves the same function as detective stories. So it says, "What was the secret sense that allowed these alien creatures to recognize one another at a glance and yet remain undetected? Was it innate or acquired? Could a normal person learn to identify them?" And it just really is analogous to the fascination of the Watson character, but literally Watson, with how does he do it? How does he know all these things? How is he able to notice these things and then come to these conclusions? Like, that science or art is just so alien to people, and people just don't understand how we can do it, and it's fascinating to them. So I think that's what he's getting at there. And then he talks about at the end, I don't know, we'll have to look into this later, but and this is in the opening and closing scenes, some other character, not Holmes, the inspector wearing a beret and a buttonhole. I wasn't expecting that reference, but there it is. Inspector Slade and Sergeant Smithers. So it says, like the Sherlocks before him, Slade is not a public enemy, but the man who delves into the sewers of society and notices what others cannot or will not see. He even has a civilizing influence on those brutal enforcers of public morality, the Metropolitan Police. So there's that idea of, there's that scapegoat idea, where not just literally, like, people wouldn't suspect, but also they have an in with the police.
What a really positive foil to the idea of the queer gothic.
Yeah,
the queer
because monster. They do have like that. They're among the creepy, the slimy, the slimy streets, the abominable crimes, the monstrous people, you know, all these guys. Horrible things, but they're the good guys. But they're able to go back and forth, put on disguises, and, you know, be amongst them, but they're the good guys. And they're even idolized, too. So it's a beautiful concept. I really like it. It's good. Now, that's the main portion of what I wanted to talk about. I felt like I was taking too much time, but that's really, that's everything. And then we there's a lot to unpack. I forced myself to skip past some things that weren't particularly relevant. But other than that, I think there was something else I found today about T-Plash. Found a review. I was trying to find I don't know if you know where to find it, or like when Wilder was talking about the way he made the film,
the interview, it's somewhere. I probably could find it if I looked for it, but it's the interview where he says that he views Sherlock Holmes as gay, and that's the way he was representing him, and that's why he was on drugs, or he had a theory that that's why Sherlock Holmes was on drugs.
I found an article, I think it was like a review, which I didn't expect, and it was very telling, and it gave me some insight. It was by Nathan Booth, so if you're curious to find it, it's just titled The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes by Billy Wilder. But he talks about, like, the private life itself, and says, in some sense, private life is not about Holmes at all. It's about our idea of Holmes. He says, it is about the way in which we think we know who is, after all, a fictional character. But is Wilder only suggesting something about the nature of Holmes as a character, or is there something more afoot? Which, yes, there is, but the screenplay, or while they were filming even, it was just the film was butchered and censored heavily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, have you read the script?
No. Which we can totally get into.
We really should. It's incredible. Okay. Especially the first half of it. There's a few extra things in it that should have been in there.
Yeah.
To just add to it.
We'll have to talk about it with Aaron.
Yes, absolutely. I was just thinking that Aaron would be great.
We'll get into the private life of Sherlock Holmes. But okay, let's rewind. So why are we talking about the private life? Why is it relevant to, like, the show itself?
It is relevant mostly because it is the adaptation that Sherlock is inspired by. And it is the first adaptation, really, to pretty much almost explicitly represent Holmes as being gay.
Mm-hmm. It really straddles the line between subtext and text.
It's pretty explicit for its time.
Yes, yes. And it could have been more so, but... Mm-hmm. And then it's the film that have really heavily influenced Mark Gatiss and Stephen Moffat, but Mark Gatiss is quoted because he talked about it as being the film
that changed his life. Yeah, it was in an interview. There was,
there was a series.
Yeah, I think... I don't know if it was for BBC or something, some sort of media conglomerate, but they had a series called The Film That Changed My Life. And so it wasn't necessarily something that Mark Gatiss said, but he was interviewed for a series that was called The Film That Changed My Life. And he talked about the private life of Sherlock Holmes. Yes. And in this interview, Mark Gatiss says that he views the private life of Sherlock Holmes as being gay and in love with Watson. And he said that it was so desperately unspoken.
Mm-hmm. Sherlock, and I'm quoting what he wrote, that that he effectively falls in love with him in the film, but it's so desperately unspoken. That idea of the unspoken is also famously connected with Wilde too, that the speech when he talks about the love that dare not speak its name. He says, he claims a Russian ballerina wants Sherlock to father her child. So in order to get out of doing that, he claims Watson and him are gay. And Watson is outraged, and when he calms down, speaks of all the women all over the world who could attest to his sexuality. So that's a bad guy. The three continents, Watson idea. Quote, he says to Sherlock, you do too, don't you? Holmes is silent, and Watson says, am I being presumptuous? There have been women, haven't there? Holmes says, the answer is yes. You are being presumptuous. Sensational.
Yes.
Beautiful. Yes. So Mark recognizes this, and I think it's telling. And Moffat also wrote The Scandal in Belgravia, and there's a lot of connections. I feel like that episode feels more like a Private Life adaptation than it does a Scandal. And
it's like nothing like The Scandal in Bohemia.
It's not.
It's like, yeah, it's pretty much the plot of The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes.
Yep.
And also the plot of, I think, a James Bond film or book, but we'll get into that later.
We can circle back to that.
Casino Royale or something. I don't know. Amy made the connection. I think it's in one of her metas, but it's Irene Adler shares a striking resemblance to Pussy Galore in whatever James Bond story that was.
Well, we'll have to look into that before we go. We talk about
ASAP. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think we can finish off. I just think that I keep going back to this review that this guy who's talking about the private life, and he doesn't mention. Oh, okay. So he does say, he says, at first viewing, one might be tempted to think that Holmes has fallen in love. That certainly seems to be what Watson thinks. And it's certainly what some reviewers think, though see Mark Gatiss for an alternate viewpoint. But on second viewing, or third, or fourth, very quickly show that such a supposition is ill-founded. But he's, like, so close. He's so wait, close. This is an article. I'll link it.
This is just a review.
So this is just an idea of what people think of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Even though Wilder himself, and this article is from 2012, but Wilder himself, granted it wasn't widely known necessarily, but he wanted to portray Holmes as gay. That's why he does cocaine. It's not a stretch. But it's also not a stretch in any sense of the term. It's pretty much, we have enough proof to definitively say that regardless of authorial intent, it's still obvious, but it's with that in mind that was intended. And it's not fair, I think, to say, well, you should go based on what the text actually is, not based on what was intended. But that's not fair, I think, because of the censorship that was involved.
Yeah, and in that same interview where Billy Wilder admits that, he does talk about the censorship issues surrounding the film.
Yeah. Which we'll have to dig to find, not dig, but I'll have to find that. And we'll talk about it when we really dive into Private Life and a Scandal. But it is really interesting because I feel like this guy, Nathan Booth, is so close, yet not quite there.
No.
Because he touches on not what the point of it is, but what it ends up being. Because I think Wilder did want to tell as best as he could the private life, but what it turns out to be is, coincidentally, what we're left with in the end, and what we are still dealing with in the show, BBC Sherlock. Because he says, we know less about Holmes' private life when the movie ends than we think we do when it begins. Indeed, we know less about Holmes by the end, the myth, the man, or the myth. He recognizes that there is a facade there. The Holmes as a character, as a myth, and a legend versus who he really is, who we actually don't know a whole lot about. But if you really look at it from a certain perspective, if you go with a certain lens, you actually can figure out who he really was if you recognize that he just wasn't allowed to be described as who he really is in his private life. And he says, which I don't know how I feel about what he says, but he says, I could talk about the dangers of attempting to probe too deeply into the mysteries around us, but would also be false to the movie. I think, if anything, the movie is about investigating the cell. The fact that Sherlock Holmes is the main character is irrelevant. Holmes is a mystery to the viewer, and as such, we project our own fears and desires onto him, which is true, but not, I think, what was intended.
Yeah, I think in some ways it speaks to why people are constantly wrong about Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
Because they sort of project what they want to see onto him.
Okay, so it says, he's an enigma like the Holmes of the books, and watching the movie ultimately reveals more what we think about the character than it does about the character himself, which is, in a sense, true, but he just doesn't want to delve into it. He thinks that the story is telling us to not be presumptuous,
mm-hmm.
Which I think really is the opposite. I think he's missing the point, because Watson is assuming that Sherlock has had sexual experience with women, and he says, yes, you're being presumptuous. The fact that he's assuming that he's straight is the presumption, like the, as if the, that's the default, is the presumption, not entertaining the possibility of something else is being presumptuous. And I think he's almost getting the point, but I think he's missing it because he just doesn't view it that way. And for whatever reason, he doesn't go into detail about that. But so I'd love to hear what Nathan Booth has to say about it, though. But yes, but it is interesting because he says that, let's simply suggest that Wilder wanted to pinpoint the essential flatness of the Holmes character, wanted to demonstrate that any roundness we give him is in fact part of ourselves. I don't know about how I feel about that.
I feel like that's missing the point.
But I think it's a callback. I think I said something about this last week, because I was talking about John York. Maybe it was off air. But there's the idea of Holmes as that flat character, or the Bond character. I think that's what I talked about. Because
I think we did talk about it on the episode.
But there's the idea that Bond is a flat character. He wants things, and that mm-hmm. drives the story, but there's no roundness. There's no need. There's no change. His character doesn't change, and he's not super well-rounded. He's a fairly two-dimensional character. It's just safe to say. And Holmes is kind of the same thing, too, if you read it in a certain way. And I think Wilder didn't want... He is, in a sense, showing us that the character is flat. What we think of Holmes as being flat, but who he actually is doesn't mean that there's nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
But we can't see it. We're being... it's there, it's just shrouded.
Yeah, I think the representations and the myth of Sherlock Holmes is flat.
Yes.
I don't think the man actually is.
No, which is what the show is really aiming to do.
Mm-hmm.
In a great way. I think that's the only thing that it's changed, which the whole show does this, season 1 through 3 at least, and that's what they're correcting.
Yes.
As we talked about last time. But then series 4 ends in such a way that it's upholding the myth. And that's the antithesis, literally the antithesis of what they're trying to do. What Wilder couldn't do, and what we would like to do, is actually look at who he is. But who he really is doesn't matter. Mary Watson tells us. It's about the stories, the legend, the myth, you know. And I think that's if that's the way that series 4 ends, and leaves us on the cliffs of insanity, is really telling.
Yes, very.
Mm-hmm. And I think a series 5 has to happen. And I think with the show following a 5X structure, it narratively feels like we're suspended in between. And we need off of that cliff, so to speak, and we need that last bit to synthesize the idea of him. So, and I don't know, what do you know about, because we can wrap up with this and we can lead into our next episode, because Moffat, how do we know, again, I know that John York worked as a commissioner for the BBC, but I feel like he references Moffat a lot.
So
we know that they know each other.
So John York commissioned Jekyll, which one of Stephen Moffat's TV shows.
Okay.
And he was the commissioner for a while at BBC. So
yeah, and we presume probably.
And he dedicates. There's a dedication at the end of the book to Stephen Moffat. However,
really,
I'm not sure if it's actually him or because it's spelled incorrectly.
Oh no no no! It's spelled. It's spelled with. It's spelled. It's oh Stephen is spelled PH.
Stephen Moffat, with a PH.
Okay.
So I don't know if that's meant to be the Stephen Moffat, or
you would think that they would have fixed that by now if it had been the actual Stephen Moffat that we know of.
Yes, I mean I remember being very confused by that, and I looked it up. I looked it up, and there is no Stephen Moffat with a PH, so I don't know if it's a typo.
And I guess acknowledgements are the least of their worries, though. Maybe,
yeah.
If it is him, I don't know who else it would be because they probably know each other. And I watched a video a long time ago of John York in an interview talking about it. So,
well, I mean, he commissioned his show, so he must.
Right. Yeah. They must have. And John York in his book referenced a lot. William Goldman. He doesn't ever mention the Princess Bride that I know of, but he does mention William Goldman multiple times as a screenwriter and as someone who knows how to tell stories. And Moffat talked about William Goldman as well as being like, if you want to know about screenwriting, just read his stuff. And if you read the Princess Bride, like the script, or watch the film, that's pretty telling. Because we feel like there's a lot of references. I would have to look at his other stuff to know maybe there is other things that we just haven't looked at. I think but Princess Bride is the most obvious one that we like to talk about because it's that meta-narrative or whatever you call it, like that frame story where we're told the story by this grandfather telling the story. And the actual like Princess Buttercup and Wesley, the five acts are there in the plot, but there's no real change, like that character change there. That's where there's a lesson that's being learned. The lesson that's being learned is not through those characters who we're led to believe are sort of the main characters of the film, but really the lesson that's being learned is the kid at the beginning of the movie who has to learn that that it's okay to care about the kissing stuff.
Yeah.
Well as the other stuff. So he's slowly learning this lesson. And his story, which I made a post about as well, where I just isolated his moments. And that in itself is a five-act story. There's missing context, but he follows that very archetypical journey.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, and Stephen Moffat has said that he really admires William Goldman, and I know William Goldman had created some rules for storytelling.
That's right. I forgot about that, yeah.
And Stephen Moffat says, I think, that he looks at that as his Bible.
Yeah.
So, interesting.
Yes, and I think, yeah, so it's telling that John York sees his story as something that's following five acts, so regardless of whether or not they're literally looking through into the woods and like following it word for word. I don't think they are, but they're intuitively, like they're tapped into that, the intuition of knowing how to tell a story, and it happens to follow. So really when those who are listening to this, when we talk about Into the Woods and John York, they all agree on how to write stories. So regardless of whether or not they're actually pulling this book open and following things literally, I don't think they necessarily are, but when John York talks about 5X structure, when we talk about 5X structure, we talk about it as something that's just inherent to a good story and the way that we tell stories, right?
Yeah, so. Pretty much.
And then John York, they most likely, because he was the commissioner, they commissioned BBC Sherlock, and they had the pilot, and then they came back with the pilot, and they loved it so much that they gave them the bigger budget and said it'll be, instead of 6 episodes, it'll be 3 episodes.
Mm.
So,
kind of neatly fits into John York's model of five act structures, yes,
which is
five acts in three parts.
Literally, yes. And there's like that one allusion of that Moffat made to really wanting to. I forget what he said. Where he talks about a five season arc, and oh, and here's my plan for a five season arc, and.
Yeah.
Oh, it really does fit so perfectly with the three episodes and the fractals, and oh, it's so good. I love it.
It really is.
It's just so perfect. It just has to be finished. Yeah, so next time when we come back, it will be less me talking, hopefully. I talk so much throughout these episodes because I'm constantly quoting stuff. But next time we plan to have a guest.
Mm-hmm.
Miranda, hopefully that will work out. Regardless, we'll still talk about it. We're going to talk about the unaired pilot, which you can watch on. It's in the special features of the DVD for season one. And
is that where it is?
Yes.
Okay, so I own it on Amazon, so I can.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where I watched it. I went through. It was really annoying though because I had to go through each scene. And then I had to go back to that page and then skip ahead. I couldn't just watch it continuously.
Oh, that sucks.
But so we're just going to, it'll just be fun. It'll just be really telling because it's not part of the canon, but.
It sets up the intentions of Mark and Steven, I think, really
well.
And
provides context, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and you think about this was a show that they were making because they wanted to make it. They didn't even know people were going to like it.
Yeah.
So they weren't trying to bait anyone at this point.
No.
They didn't have an audience.
No. And they went into it thinking like, oh, we get to have a bigger budget? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Love it. They thought it was just going to be this fun, campy show that they would do a few seasons of, and yay. And they were lucky to get a second season, which they have the talent, but I think every filmmaker and TV show writer knows that film, television, it's just not a given. You can't always finish it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it depends on, you know, the success, and that's kind of how networks work. If you don't have the need for it, they're not going to want to renew the season because it's not going to be worth their money.
Yeah. So I think
they
didn't
really know.
Yeah. So I think the unaired pilot is like, well, we don't know, so let's just throw everything at it.
the production quality is not great.
No. No, but they had more fun with it in a mm-hmm. more obvious way. Whereas when they knew, oh, they like this, we get more money and we
have
to do
take
better.
It slower.
We might have to take it slower, yeah. And because we might have a better chance at getting a second season. So let's just take it more safe or plan for long term rather than short term. A lot of people like to posit that or guess that like, oh, if the unaired pilot had been what we actually ended up getting, they would have been happily together by the end of the first season or whatever. Which I don't know, maybe.
So, yeah. I think we should probably wrap this up.
Yes.
I actually just got a text message. I have a thing to do in like a few minutes.
Oh, no. Okay. Well, tune in next time. We're going to talk about the unaired pilot. Thank you so much for listening to all of the 2 hours of this. Hopefully we can cut it down, but
hopefully next week we'll be able to go through this a little bit more quickly. And
yes, for
once
sure,
we get
for
into
sure.
the episode breakdowns, it should be a lot more digestible.
Yes, absolutely. All right. Well, thank you so much for listening. We'll hear from you next time, hopefully. By the time this airs, we would have already heard some feedback on the first episode, so we'll see. All right, see you guys.